Sagar and Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
So to me, it was really obvious writing in, you know, Marshall mentioned predictive power. I really did get it right in the afterword of the paperback to World on Fire. I predicted it. I said, we've just gone into Iraq. I know everybody's hopeful, but here's what I think is going to happen. I think that suddenly democratizing in a country where this hated Sunnis led by Saddam Hussein has been killing, you know, Shias and oppressing these poor Shias for just decades. Once we have elections, you know what's going to happen? You're going to see all these demagogues, these Shias belonging to the majority saying, the Sunnis are horrible. They're our enemy. We need to get rid of them.
This week, we're very excited to be joined by Yale professor Amy Chua. She's a professor there at the law school. But more importantly, for our purposes, she's written a number of books, including World on Fire and Political Tribes, both aimed at dissecting the American foreign policy elite and what they get completely wrong whenever we're looking at foreign adventurism, at actually military intervention, what the West completely misunderstands societies, but more importantly, what the West misunderstands about itself. And that is what this episode is all about.
This is the perfect follow-up to our conversation with Lieutenant General Dan Bolger. We wanted to talk to General Bolger because he wrote a book 7 years ago about how he thought our wars in Iraq and Afghanistan were going to end in failure. And Amy's really interesting because she wrote a book, World on Fire, How Exporting Free Market Democracy Breeds Ethnic Hatred and Global Instability, in 2003 and 2004. So this is a person who can look at the situation that we're seeing in Afghanistan right now and our other broader interventions across the broader Middle East and Central Asia and say, told you so. So it's really interesting to speak to people like that, especially when putting forth these opinions were not exactly fashionable nor particularly convenient for people in power. So this is the perfect follow-up to it. And the most important part here, too, is that with Amy's more recent book, Political Tribes, is that she ties these themes of the American elite's blind spots to actually the domestic side. So how does an American coastal elite have blind spots in the same way that they had blind spots in Iraq and Afghanistan? How does that apply to Donald Trump? How does it apply to the future of our politics? A lot of really great stuff. We know everyone who loved our episode of Dan Bolger is going to really love this one as well, too. Now, we are about to get into the episode, but we are going to run through the great stuff we have for everyone here. Now, of course, Amy has a bunch of books, and they are all really fun. For those of you who recognize the name in a totally different context, you may remember her as the Tiger Mother. She wrote Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother in 2011 and caused quite a stir for the fact that the book was a big commentary on parenting. I read it a couple years ago. It's really fun. It's great to get a book which is totally outside of our politics and policy space. But once again, there's World on Fire, there's Political Tribes. Go to the bookshop, help support local booksellers. I just did some math. We have literally sold tens and tens and thousands of dollars worth of books in the last year. And that's just really crazy. We obviously get a very small percentage of that, but it's actually just really cool that authors are noticing that you all move books for us. So huge thank you to everyone who does that. Go follow the link. And then secondly, it's Thursday, so our Substack is going out. We are continuing to get more and more subscribers. It's really great that you all are here. And we'd love for you to join us and get a couple more of our takes, see what the books we're reading, all of that really great stuff. And finally, and most importantly, we have hit capacity on the Realignment Conference. Huge thank you to everyone who came and joined. We're putting together a wait list in case there are any dropouts. But, you know, to everyone who came and signed up and paid, we really, really, really appreciate it. And we're looking forward to doing more events in the future. We're definitely going to have a lot of great stuff in 2022. We're really into looking into doing a meetup somewhere. So stuff that isn't going to cost money or require that many of you to hop on a flight to Miami in the fall. Lastly, Lincoln Network, our sponsor, is putting on a really interesting conversation with Peter Thiel the same week as we are running our Realignment Conference. It's going to happen on October 20th. It's going to be really interesting. There's going to be a really broad conversation. I'm going to moderate a panel. If you're interested in a lot of the ideas we focus on the show, whether it's the future of politics, the technology industry, stagnation, why everyone gets this vague feeling that this country isn't going in the right direction, Peter is a really excellent thinker, speaker, frankly, even operator on all those topics. So it's a great conversation. There's a link in the show notes. Go check that out as well if you're looking to join. I believe we still have early bird pricing for that as well too. All right, a lot of great stuff there, but let's get into this really amazing episode. Amy Chua, welcome to The Realignment.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah.
Folks should think about this episode in the context of our episode with retired Lieutenant General Dan Bolger last week. We have been covering Afghanistan through the lens of thinkers, writers, practitioners who put forth work that almost predicted, to a certain degree, the outcomes that we're seeing this week and in coming weeks. We should not think of this as an episode that's about what's exactly going down on the ground, but more the actual intellectual and even geopolitical, ethnic, tribal context as all these things happen about. So, Amy, you're actually the perfect person to address this with, because back in the early 2000s, 2003, 2004, you wrote a book called World on Fire. I will read the under part, which is how exporting free market democracy breeds ethnic hatred and global instability. Because what I really want to highlight here before we dive in is this idea that we've gotten a lot of audience feedback. And the thing that people do not understand, the number one question we've gotten is, what made the American foreign policy elite think that it was a worthwhile project to spend 10, 20 long-term decades rebuilding, turning Afghanistan into a democracy, importing market values, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the number one thing I got from reading your book is this idea that you wrote this book in response to a very specific political moment, which was after the fall of the Berlin Wall, the Cold War, where the obvious answer is, why would we not turn Afghanistan into a democracy? We beat the Soviets, history's over. So can you actually start by explaining the intellectual space that you were writing against? Whether it's Francis Fukuyama, whether it's neoliberalism, start by defining that space.
Great. Yeah. Especially because I think a lot of your listeners weren't even born during that phase. But, in the late 80s, early 90s, with the collapse of the former Soviet Union, it really was this worldwide euphoria. It wasn't just the United States. It was kind of led by the United States. But a lot of people all over the world, from Latin America to Asia, felt like exactly what you said. They're like, okay, so there used to be two models, right? The sort of authoritarian communist model, and then there's free market democracy. And the Soviet Union collapsed. It failed. So there's only one solution left, and it's got to be free markets and democracy. And during that time, I was, just in my 30s, the solution was, we have to spread markets everywhere. Let's privatize everything. I was actually working on Wall Street and worked on the privatization of Mexico's phone company. And also, let's democratize everything. And Marshall, they did it, it's with all good intentions, but it's classic sort of American. They just thought it was going to be so easy, in terms of, instead of thinking, what does it mean to have a democracy? Exactly what is it? How do we implement it? It was just, let's ship out a bunch of ballot boxes. Let's have elections tomorrow. And a big feature that they didn't realize is that so much of the world has all these ethnic divisions. So to answer your question, I bet a lot of readers, they ask, how could they think this? Why did they think that we would be successful? One answer is Germany and Japan. Because after the Second World War, these were incredibly, they were enemy countries, they were a mess. And the United States, with the Marshall Plan, went in and they're sort of like, look what happened. There are these thriving free market democracies. But what's interesting about those two countries is that they are both incredibly ethnically homogeneous, right? Like in Germany, partly because there was genocide, it was almost only just ethnic Germans. There were no ethnic or religious divisions. And same with Japan. It's like 95% ethnic Japanese. So it wasn't a great model for looking at countries like Afghanistan or Iraq or other countries.
So here's the thing, Professor Chua. This is a courageous book to write in the middle of 2003, 2004. I wasn't even a teenager yet, but even I remember, you know, the ooh-rah mentality. Somebody recently flagged for me Glenn Beck's book from 2002, in which he said it was un-American, the idea that we could not accomplish the democracy building projects in Iraq and Afghanistan. So what was it that uniquely you were able to see and articulate in the book World on Fire that cut across this? And you accomplished something, because I went back and I read, you actually were able to penetrate the elite bubble at the time and at least convince some people to be like, okay, you know what, this is a pretty good point over here. This whole thing may not work out.
Yeah, thank you for those nice words. You know, a lot of it, I think it's from my own personal perspective. I think I come from a family that came from the developing world. So my parents are Chinese, but they lived in the Philippines. So they were part of this little tiny ethnic minority. And I coined this term in World on Fire called market dominant minority. And most Americans just aren't familiar with this. Because we're used to kind of like a white majority that's both politically and economically dominant. They haven't heard of this phenomenon where the Chinese in the Philippines are only 1% of the population. I mean, that's tiny, and yet they control as much as 60 to 70% of the economy, of the retail sector, the technology sector, the finance sector. And, you know, a lot of Americans, they're like, that's got to be a stereotype. And I document in World on Fire in a very kind of empirical way. No, actually, this is the situation. So a lot of people in developing countries were always wealthy elites, especially if you belong to this little outsider group that happens to be wealthy. They were always terrified of democracy. You know, Americans, we had this luxury. It's like, markets and democracy, they seem to be kind of great. You know, we've had it for 200 years. I mean, there's some problems, but in a lot of these countries, it was their experience that, you know, in a country where a small ethnic minority controls so much of the economy, like the group that my parents came from, if you have overnight democracy, what you would see over and over is you would see the rise of these demagogues, right? Uneducated people, not necessarily proposing sound economic policies, but they'd say, so they'd belong to this poor majority ethnic group. And they'd say, you know why you're poor? It's because of this outsider ethnic group. They're stealing all your money. They don't even belong in this country. That's why they're poor. Vote for me in democratic elections and I will confiscate their stuff, or I will take all of their land and give you back what is rightfully yours, or we will kick them out. Idi Amin did this in Uganda. Yep. The Indians were a tiny market dominant minority. And you know, you look at this guy, now that wasn't a democracy, but he had a lot, he was a populist. He had a lot of majority support. And he was like, you know why we're poor here in Uganda? It's because of these Indians. I'm gonna expel them. And while he was horribly disliked in many other ways, that was a very popular move. Same with Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe with whites. He was like, yes, these people, you know, became dictators and you know, I'm not saying they're great Democrats, but if you mm-hmm. look at how they came to power and how they retained power for so many years, the answer wasn't just violence. They also got a lot of play, a lot of people liked them because they said, stick with me, have me as your leader. I'm going to confiscate all these white people's land. There's colonizers anyways, they don't belong here. So the answer to your question is, outside the developing world, this is a phenomenon that a lot of people live with daily. You know, it's a funny story. When my mom read World on Fire, you know, it made the best New York Times bestseller list for like 1 week, you know, that's for, you know, 50 seconds, that's all you need. But my mom, who had never really understood my work, she starts reading this and she's like, wait, Amy, this is what you're writing about? These, like the Chinese in Indonesia and the Philippines and Malaysia. She's like, everybody knows about this. And I was like, no, Mom, actually not. Like, you know about it because we're from there. So I think that's the perspective that I brought as somebody from a developing country myself, where people, and trust me, all of the elites in Latin America, they have been terrified about populism for at least 100 years. So it's a uniquely kind of a US perspective to in some ways be so romantic about free market democracy.
You know, I'm glad you brought it to that example, because a good way of summing up this episode and also just the tie that brings your books together, this idea that the American foreign policy elite has these massive blind spots. And I'd love for you to tell the story, which was one of my favorite parts of Political Tribes, which was Hugo Chavez. I understood Hugo Chavez is this populist. He's a socialist, Marxist, communist, all sorts of really bad policies, all sorts of like really, really terrible things. There's no defense of him, I think. But the angle that you brought up is one that I'd never considered, which is the racial angle. So it was fascinating to hear, and I'll let you tell the story because it's your book, but it was just fascinating to hear you talk about how in the 90s, you would talk about how, hey, like, I'm not like this country's white minority. I have black features. I am not just, a typical white passing Venezuelan. And what's interesting to blind spot is I always thought he was just Hispanic. So it's interesting that even at the American level, I did not think that he would refer to his broader nose or his bigger lips as black. So I would just love for you to give that articulation of this.
Yeah, you know, I got in a lot of trouble for even bringing this up. Again, this is, it's also what, you know, made the book do so well. It got so controversial. But yes, in U.S. foreign policy, we tend to view the world in terms of these grand ideological battles, like capitalism versus communism, or democracy versus authoritarianism, or, you know, the free world versus the axis of evil. And we're kind of blinded by these ideological prisms. And then, so we fail to see we ignore these really powerful group identities that are operating on the ground that are really the most powerful and meaningful to the people in these countries. And we just kind of are totally ignorant about them. So in Venezuela, like a lot of Latin American countries, they often say, we don't have any racism here. You know, you guys in America, you have black and white, but we, because of this great racial mixing, we're all mestizos. And to a certain extent, that is true. Much more than the United States, the Spaniard and Portuguese colonizers, they intermixed with the native Indians, the indigenous peoples. I mean, slaughtering them too, but also, you know, raping or marrying, so, or just, you know, mm-hmm. having progeny with them, and also with the slaves in some cases. So in Venezuela, you have this situation where I'm going to say like 70% of the country basically were darker skinned. I don't know if you would exactly call them black, but he would say, I have African features because there were a lot of slaves brought over, or I have Indian features. I'm a Pardo. They have brown skin, thick lips. And he would talk about that. But what people never acknowledged is that Venezuela also had a market dominant minority. It was it wasn't ethnic in the sense, like it wasn't just the Chinese, you know, or Indians or, you know, Jews in some countries, but it was this group of kind of lighter skinned, Europeanized white people who often had blonde hair and blue eyes or, you know, green eyes. And they had come from Germany or Ireland because, you know, Latin America had these great waves of immigration also. So at the top of all these countries, Mexico, Bolivia, you know, Peru, and Venezuela, you have this little crust of, you know, it could be 5 to 10, depending on how you, 10% of the population that are lighter featured, but they often are educated at the Kennedy School. You know, they speak English and they look essentially white, and they controlled the banks, the businesses, all of the foreign investment connections, the education. And for all of Venezuela's history, like other Latin American countries, that's who ran the show. You know, they both controlled the economy and the politics. So when Hugo Chavez arrived, a lot of the elites were not threatened by him. They're like, this guy, he's this former paratrooper. He's like so uneducated. Who's going to vote for him? But he basically, you're right. He wasn't really that much of he is socialist and he did confiscate a lot of land, but he also played the ethnic card. He said, vote for somebody who looks like you. And in fact, like 60 to 70% of that country look like him. And, you know, he said, let's get rid of, he was a demagogue, right? I mean, you're right. He did a lot of terrible things, but he targeted these rich oligarchs. He's like, look at these oligarchs. They look like country club people. They look down on you. And it had never really been tried before, because there is so much, when you have that much racism in a lot of Latin American countries, nobody wanted to admit to being having Indian blood or African blood. They were all trying to whiten themselves, you know. But he was the first person in Venezuela to really turn that around and saying, I'm proud of this brown skin. So that's how we swept to power. And both the United States and the elites in that country were just dumbfounded. They just didn't expect him to be that popular. You know, and immediately all the foreign policy elites said, oh, he's a dictator. Now, he had a lot of authoritarian tendencies. But the truth is, guys, he was democratically elected, you know, the first time. And then he was reelected. And for a long time, people tried to say, no, it's got to be corruption or something. But the fact is, a lot of poor, dark-skinned people voted for him. And so I describe the tragedy of Venezuela as really the contest between a very powerful, former, market-dominant kind of white, lighter-skinned elite against this populist guy that honestly didn't have any good economic policies. You know, when he came to power, he did confiscate. He made a lot of mistakes. He disbanded the Congress. But we just missed that entirely in the United States. We just kept thinking, wait, this is all about communism. What's going on? Mm-hmm.
No, and that's so important. To take it back to the Afghanistan part here, I want to not play devil's advocate, but once again, give a clear understanding of the 2001 to 2003 world that everyone's looking at. So the key claim that you are making in the book was that, and it's once again in the title, that free market democracy, the export thereof, actually causes global instability. So once again, to take it to the questions we're getting from the audience, there really is this there's this focus on why after 2001, December 2001, did we not just leave once it was clear we weren't going to capture Osama bin Laden? And the theory at the time, this isn't a conspiracy, this isn't weapons contractors paying people to the table. The theory was, hey, look at the world of the post-Cold War. Where are we getting Al-Qaeda terrorist training camps? Where are we getting young, ticked off young men? They are coming from third world countries that are not democratic, that are not representative. If you're looking at the places that actually harbored Al-Qaeda, Sudan, Afghanistan, these were countries that were not free market democracies. Obviously, everyone likes to dunk on the fact that most of the hijackers from 9/11 were from Saudi Arabia. Obviously, we weren't going to invade Saudi Arabia, but if you actually talk to the thinkers who are promoting free market democratic transformation, they would say, actually, Saudi Arabia is proof point of what we are talking about. These non-democratic, non-capitalistic, theocratic states are hotbeds and breeding grounds for terrorism. So if we do not actually work to transform these countries, this cycle will continue forever and ever and ever. So I would just love to hear your response to, I think, my good faith articulation of what the folks who were in opposition to you were arguing at the time.
Great. Yeah. So first of all, this might be surprising, but I agree with a lot of that. So there are some people now that are like, we need to have authoritarianism, you know, because democracy is too dangerous. I'm not in that camp. I actually favor free market democracy. I actually do think that's the best system we can have. So my difference with a lot of those people is really more about how we get there. You know, how do we implement this? And as I said, we had this incredibly superficial way of doing it, right? Because also, what are free markets exactly, right? We were literally like airlifting in a stock exchange, you know, like dumping it in the middle of Kazakhstan, right? You know, like in the United States, in Europe, even more so. But, you know, we have a lot of redistributive networks. We have safety nets. We have social security. And people may disagree. They may think we have too much taxes. But it's not just like raw capitalism. And people also forget, because we don't like to remember how dark our own history is. But, you know, we did not have universal suffrage in this country for a long time. When we started off with democracy, it was just like a small group of property owners. You know, we didn't let the poor vote. We obviously didn't let minorities vote. We didn't let women vote. And there were sort of property qualifications, and we slowly expanded the suffrage. But what we're doing now, it's just politically not possible. You can't say that now. But the effect of what we're doing is when we are trying to bring democracy to Afghanistan or Iraq, we're basically trying to do it overnight. Like, let's go straight to universal suffrage, you know, give everybody the vote. My response to that is, my first point is, if we want to try to bring markets and democracy, which again, I think is the best combination, we need to do two things. First, we need to understand what the dynamics on the ground are. You know, what are the religious structures? What are the ethnic structures? Because I got to tell you, most of the developing world is completely different than the United States. We're a very idiosyncratic country. So first, to understand the group dynamics, then we can figure out, you know, how markets and democracy are going to play there. For example, something I talk about with these market dominant minorities is, in the United States, a lot of people think, and it's actually happened in our past for a lot of people, that markets will lift all boats. You know, it's not every last person, but a lot of different people will rise. In these countries where you have like a little market dominant minority that's got this head start, they dominate the banks, finance, the retail. When you bring in free markets, all of the foreign investors will work with this little outsider ethnic minority. So markets actually just enriches this little group of minority. And then democracy will empower the majority. So basically, in a lot of countries, markets and democracy will benefit not just different people or different classes, but actually different ethnic groups. So it's a very different dynamic than the United States. You know, you have markets enriching this little group, and then democracy empowering this angry group that's been left out because of markets. And then you're going to get these demagogues that say, vote for me. And democracy in those cases can often sweep in a leader that is anti-market. Like they're so markets and democracy is one of the main points of World on Fire is, we expect markets and democracy to just always work hand in hand. They always go together. And I tried to show that in a lot of countries, democracy and markets actually are at odds. They, you know, the democracy can sweep in anti-market leaders. Case in point, Hugo Chavez, right? He was democratically elected and he, you know, pursued these socialist policies. So that was point one. Understand the group dynamics of the country that you're trying to democratize and marketize. And the second point is, let's be a little bit more sophisticated about what we mean by free markets and democracy. What are we going to put in there exactly? And what I was just saying is, and it sounds like I'm making fun of it, but I'm telling you, when you look at Iraq, it's pretty much what we did. Shipping off ballot boxes. Let's just have an election tomorrow. You know, after the Iraq war, they're like, let's have an election. And then at a certain point in US intelligence, we're like, oh no, if we do this, it looks like these terrorists are going to win. So then they canceled elections. And that didn't look good. So, you know, we need to think much more carefully about how you go about implementing, you know, democratic politics and free markets.
Can you relate this not just to Iraq, but Iraq, Afghanistan, Vietnam, as you do in the book, and how it kind of specifically foils the way that the American foreign policy elite thinks and then what it runs into in practice?
Great. So I'll take Afghanistan and Iraq kind of together, because that was during this phase right after 9/11, where rightfully so, you know, we were horrified. In our sort of ideological framework, it was all about terrorists and fundamentalists. It was kind of the West against fundamentalism. And we were just completely blind to all these really complicated ethnic and tribal and sectarian differences in both countries. So in Iraq, it was, you know, everybody kind of knew that there were these Sunnis and Shias and Kurds. But again, it was a very American perspective, which is, you know what, in America, we used to have Irish people and Italians and Poles, but we just had free market democracy and they all intermixed and they became Americans. And it sounds crazy, but that was actually the attitude, which is like, if we just can bring in some markets and tap into that oil wealth and democratize, these people that look kind of the same to us anyway, will just come together as Iraqis. Huge mistake, because it turns out that in Iraq, that country too also had a market dominant minority. In that country, the Sunnis are about Well, they were about 14, 15% of the population, again, a minority. They had sort of dominated that country for hundreds of years, first under the Ottomans. The Ottomans were a Sunni power, right? They were Turkish, but they were a Sunni power. And then under the British loved to do divide and conquer. That's how they maintained their colonial power. And they loved to find minorities. And they went to the Sunnis. They're like, oh, we're going to empower these Sunnis, give them access to oil, and it's going to keep these majority Shias, you know, at bay. And finally, under Saddam Hussein, who, again, was a Sunni, and he was terrible. He was a dictator who funneled all the wealth and all the opportunities to his fellow Sunnis. So to me, it was really obvious writing in, you know, Marshall mentioned predictive power. I really did get it right in the afterword of the paperback to World on Fire. I predicted it. I said, we've just gone into Iraq. I know everybody's hopeful, but here's what I think is going to happen. I think that suddenly democratizing in a country where this hated Sunnis led by Saddam Hussein has been killing, you know, Shias and oppressing these poor Shias for just decades. Once we have elections, you know what's going to happen? You're going to see all these demagogues, these Shia belonging to the majority, saying the Sunnis are horrible. They're our enemy. We need to get rid of them, you know, and these Islamic kind of fundamentalist things. And that's what we saw. We saw these demagogic Shia clerics saying, vote for me, vote for me. And they started targeting the Sunnis. So the Sunni minority then saying, wait a minute, democracy is not working out for us. You know, we're going to get kicked out. We used to be in power. What did they do? They resisted democracy, and many of them joined what became ISIS. They essentially said, wait a minute, this is not working out for us. And the U.S. just missed this entire dynamic, which I did predict exactly to a T. Afghanistan was a little bit different because they didn't have a clear market dominant minority. The mistake we made there is that we saw everything as fundamentalist versus, you know, West. And we didn't realize that for most of Afghanistan's history, so Afghanistan has at least 14 ethnic groups, and the largest three are the Pashtuns, the Tajiks, and the Uzbeks, and then the Hazaras. Mm-hmm. And when we invaded in 2000, we missed the fact that the Taliban is not just an Islamic fundamentalist movement, but also, and arguably primarily, an ethnic movement. Largely founded and populated and led by Pashtuns. So the Pashtuns had ruled the country for hundreds of years. The Pashtuns founded the country. All of the leaders up until the Cold War had been Pashtuns. But then during the Cold War, they started to lose their dominance under the Russians. And it was against that background that the Taliban emerged. And we just missed all this. We just kind of saw these guys as a bunch of cave-dwelling mullahs. We didn't realize, wait, there's an ethnic component. And sort of to make a long story short, we got played by Pakistan because in, you know, back in the 90s, we outsourced our policies to the Pakistanis, who were incredibly aware of these ethnic dynamics and kind of played us. That's how we ended up arming many of the people that became the Taliban. But fast forwarding back to after 9/11, what we did after we intervened, so we crushed it militarily. You know, it looked like we won. You know, it's like, hey, the Taliban, we defeated them. No, not true at all. Basically, the Taliban just disbanded. They fled up into the mountains. And what we did to win was we allied ourselves with these two other groups, the Tajiks and the Uzbeks, completely oblivious to the fact that the sort of most of the people in this country, these Pashtuns, view these people as the enemies, people that had killed their parents and grandparents. So we were essentially going to this country and we are allying ourselves with people that the majority or the largest ethnic group Pashtuns hates. So we kind of shot ourselves in the foot without knowing it. And when we set up this the government, again, we put in power a lot of these Uzbeks and Tajiks. And I understand the rationale there. A lot of people were like, we can't let the Taliban anywhere near the government. So they just kind of excluded anybody that had even the remotest ties to the Taliban. The problem is Afghanistan is a clan-based society. And there were a lot of Pashtuns that they didn't like the Taliban. They were very progressive. They weren't even fundamentalists. But, you know, they had clan-based ties to some other pashtuns that might have belonged to the Taliban. But the point is that we missed all of these subtle tribal ethnic dynamics, and we shot ourselves in the foot. We didn't understand how much staying power the Taliban had, because they, at a certain point when there was so much chaos, so there were a lot of things going on. After we picked up and left because we thought we won, we moved on to Iraq. All of this corruption and lawlessness set in. And the Taliban, one thing they were very good at is they brought order. You know, they said, look, we're going to stabilize. And they also provided a lot of services and food. And finally, the way they won over is they went to these groups that were primarily Pashtuns, their own people. And they said, look what happened, you know, when the U.S. was here. We're just getting bullets. These Tajiks and Uzbeks are getting rich. Join us. And that is, if you look at what happened just last month, essentially everyone's like, wait, how did it happen so fast? Well, that it's a version of the same thing. You know, they kind of, a lot of people just folded. They started with a lot of Pashtun areas and people just folded. And, you know, we completely missed this ethnic dynamic.
I want to take this to the U.S. domestic politics side, because we're talking about tribalism, because that's the other half of the book here, especially from the 2018-2019 version. Something I'm just thinking about is, it seems clear to me that with the rise of the internet and the decentralization of media, America is just becoming, and this is obvious, but I think it's important to think about it at a theoretical level, America is just getting more and more tribal, in the sense that it's easier and easier and easier to, as a politician, as a demagogue, identify your tribe. And I'm really interested in how political leaders, not at a policy level, but actually as a how does governing work, how do they respond to this dynamic? So, for example, it's actually very plausible that you as a politician could realize, hey, I can get very popular by appealing to the Fox News tribe, or I could really prioritize the Lincoln Project or MSNBC or a book deal in order to appeal to a tribe and sell more things than I would, because once again, no one is marketing or trying to organize around a broader coalition of people. So what I want to know is, how do you think folks who see this status quo and want to move beyond just the appeal to tribalism, because the appeal to tribalism will not work. There's never going to be a winner take all system where Fox News tribe can win or MSNBC tribe can win, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I want to know, how do you think politics should operate in this specific dynamic? Because the last thing I'll add here is that, as Sagar and I have done the show for the past 2 years, I've gotten less and less interested in specific policy prescriptions as the solution to any problem we have, because that suggests that the problem we have as a society is that we can't quite figure out the right version of Medicare for all, or we can't quite figure out the right exact actual immigration policy, when actually it turns out that it doesn't seem like we have a leadership class that understands how to navigate a tribalized America. So I would just love to hear your thoughts on this framework.
I so agree with your take. So I'll start with an anecdote. When I was writing this new book, Political Tribes, that came out in 2018, which is sort of like an updated version of World on Fire. So it was like 2016, 2017. And I did predict the election of Donald Trump. I was not surprised by that. But I was teaching a class that I've taught for 20 years, based on World on Fire. And so what I've been saying for like, you know, 15 years was, the reason we keep getting U.S. foreign policy wrong in all these countries like Vietnam and Afghanistan is that our dynamics here in the U.S. are so different from the developing world. So we keep screwing it up. So this is a funny anecdote. In my class, I was actually reading a passage about Hugo Chavez, and this is literally 3 months after Donald Trump got elected. So it's like, in developing countries, unlike the United States, you know, if you have a market dominant minority, what you will see is a demagogue politician, often with no political experience, sweep to power in elections to the horror of elites by scapegoating this kind of, elite and tapping into deep social and racial resentments. And there was this dead silence because I was actually describing Hugo Chavez. And of course, this young woman raises her hand and she's like, Professor Chua, that sounds just like what happened in the United States. So I had 3 months to get in my book, and I completely revised my thesis of Political Tribes. And so one of the main points of political tribes now is that for the first time in US history, we are starting to exhibit destructive political dynamics that historically were much more typical of developing countries that we just didn't have in this country. And we've had a lot of problems, racism, slavery, but we didn't have some things that we are starting to see now. For example, the rise of ethno-nationalist movements. Like we have open white nationalist movements now.
Not to interrupt, can you explain why there was a division between developing and developed countries? Like what about a developed society made it so that we didn't have this?
Exactly. So I was going to get to that. So I changed political tribes to figure out what is different about this moment. Why is it now that the United States is starting to act like a developing country? And the answer, this is perfect because it takes us full circle, Marshall, is I think there are two factors that make this moment different in the United States. The first is this massive demographic transformation that we have been seeing, you know, over the last 50 years. For the first time in U.S. history, as you guys know, whites are about to lose their majority status at the national level. That's never happened before, right? It's always been whites, both politically and economically dominant for 200 years. But depending on the statistics, you know, according to the U.S. Census, by 2044, according to Pew, by 2050, but sometime around there, people disagree about what it will look like. But basically, it's already happened in a lot of states and big cities. Whites are going to lose their majority status. Why is that important? Because all these psychological studies show that it's when, so right now, it's not just minorities who feel threatened. You know, it used to be like African-Americans and Indian-Americans and Asian-Americans, they were the ones that felt threatened. Now, whites feel threatened too, right? Every group in America feels threatened. It's not just religious minorities like Muslim Americans or Hindu Americans or Jews. Christians feel threatened, right? So that's one dynamic. All of these studies show that it's when groups feel threatened, that's when they retreat into tribalism. They get much more defensive and insular, much more us versus them. So that's factor one, this huge demographic change. Factor two, and I think this is perfect, I think we are seeing for the first time in US history, the rise of our own idiosyncratic version of a market dominant minority. We've never had one of these. People used to say, oh, Jews control the country. It's not true. Bill Gates is not Jewish. Warren Buffett is not Jewish. But just in the last 10 or so years, we have developed this phenomenon that Donald Trump really tapped into, which is for a lot of parts of the country, they see I guess what they would call coastal elites as our own version of this outsider market dominant minority. So there's this little, it is true that wealth in the United States is incredibly concentrated on our coasts. You know, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, Hollywood, all the Ivy League schools, Washington, the swamp, you know, the financial centers. So from the point of view of a lot of people in the middle of the country, rural America, Southern America, it's like everything is controlled by this little group that, and you know what? They don't even care about real Americans. They want to help all these immigrants. And they also care more about the poor in Africa than they do about the poor right here in Appalachia. And what I wrote in Political Tribes is what happened in the election that brought Donald Trump to power is exactly what I would have predicted for a developing country with a market dominant minority. That is the rise of a populist leader that said, you know why you guys are not happy? You know, because there's this little group that's controlling everything and they don't even like you. You know, so vote for me and let's turn America into the place it used to be. Make America great again, right? Let's take it out of the hands of all these people. And we did get this rise of a populist demagogue who, you know, that's why a lot of people voted for him. Again, a lot of my coastal elite friends, just they're like, they couldn't understand it. They're like, wait, this is a billionaire. I don't understand. How did it? And I saw it perfectly. He was, you know, from a funny point of view, culturally, Donald Trump is a lot more like these blue collar people that voted for him. He eats pizza. He's not politically correct. He's always getting in trouble for not being feminist enough, you know. And that worked, you know, watches world wrestling, you know, and NASCAR. So That's the answer, Marshall. And that's what's so interesting about the book, that to go to your question about how do we overcome this? I mean, we are really at a tough moment. We're at a tough moment because, like developing countries now, it's easier to get votes by tapping into hatred, right? It's if you come up and say, hey, let's unify, nobody's going to click retweet you on Twitter. You know, it's, you know, you only social media, you mentioned, that just rewards people who just get really angry and demonize the other side. To me, I actually am an independent myself, but I believe it or not, some of now President Biden's main advisors actually read Political Tribes. And going for those Midwestern states that he won, you'll notice that he did a very unifying message. You know, he did not do what the left of his movement wanted, and he tried to steer clear of that. So for me, the hopeful thing is it's a concept I introduced in Political Tribes. What makes us different from developing countries? We have to think about what, okay, I don't think we're like a developing country, right? I think that we are exhibiting some dynamics, but we've got some special things. First, we are so lucky that the US identity is actually not ethnic. You know, a lot of these countries, it really is blood-based, like China. It's like Han Chinese. That's who founded this country. Our identity is actually rooted in principle. If you will subscribe to the values of the US Constitution, you can be American. Now, immediately, as my students always remind me, we have failed to live up to those principles. We had slavery while we had the Constitution. True enough. Nevertheless, we can't forget what a gift it is that we've got this advantage, that our national identity, in theory, in principle, is enough to encompass all these people. And so one of the things that most distresses me is I see among younger people, oh, you know, the Constitution, that's just that's a racist document, or our founding fathers, you know, those are just white male rapists. And what I always tell young people is like, look, there's a huge difference between saying that we have these great principles in our US Constitution, and but we have shamefully and repeatedly failed to live up to them. And the people that implemented them themselves were racist, and they made all these mistakes, but we've got to try to stick to those principles. There's a huge difference between that and just throwing the baby out with the bathwater and saying the whole Constitution is racist and just, you know, it's all smoke. The Constitution is really just a, you know, an excuse for white supremacy. I think if we go there, it's going to be really dangerous, because what is going to hold this country together? You know, it, as you say, it can't be Fox News or MSNBC. I mean, they're always going against the other side. It can't, anything like that's coming from the right on any, if we start to go the route of developing countries and saying US identity has to be defined by an ethnic group, like it's got to be whites or it's got to be Christians or Europeans, or the opposite, it, whites are terrible, it's got to be only by people of color. We're actually moving away from the US ideal, which is that anyone can be an American. And so I feel like that is the secret, that we've got to find a way to teach your listeners how to not whitewash our history. I'm totally in favor of that. We got to tell the truth, but not to overcorrect and forget what is kind of special about this country, because that's the only thing that can conceivably hold this country together. And what makes us different from Iraq? I mean, the problem with a country like Iraq is there was never a really strong overarching Iraq identity. People always felt more Sunni or Shia or Kurd. Afghanistan, forget it. I mean, it's like, you know, Pashtun, Tajik, the whole idea of this Afghanistan overarching national identity, that's been the problem. They don't have anything close to that. You know, even a country like Pakistan is the same thing. But we are different in the United States. And I think that's something that we just, you know, we can be critical, but we don't want to overcorrect.
Something I'm curious from your perspective, given that you teach at Yale, is I've increasingly believed that given the concentration of cultural power and economic power amongst, you know, so-called coastal elites, professional managerial class, whatever you want to call it, you know, the highly educated, et cetera, is that the only way in order to, I guess, turn down the temperature is actually to make them realize that they're being crazy, if that makes sense. It's like even getting them to acknowledge, hey, other people think differently than us. Hey, a lot of the country actually didn't go to college or have any of the same cultural experiences as us whatsoever and thinks differently. That's actually the only way out because they run everything. Yeah. This has been a major critique leveled against me. But I look at the Trump presidency and I don't really know how you can think otherwise, given that you had the ultimate outsider who was mostly boxed in because they were an outsider. Like, actually, as we're learning with this Afghan withdrawal, it takes somebody who is a literal creature of the swamp in order to know the ways of the swamp to say, no, I'm not going to fall for this once again. What do you think is the most effective way to make people of this new tribe realize that they themselves are part of the problem?
Yeah, and I love that point, because one of the things I've said is a lot of these coastal elites, they think of themselves as the opposite of tribal, mm-hmm. because they think of themselves as really cosmopolitan. We love all people of the world. You know, we're anti-racist. We're, you know, and it was quite a controversial point in political tribes to say, you don't realize how tribal you are, how arrogant and also how insular. If you look at this little group of coastal elites, and, you know, they're all my friends, I'm one of them. I mean, we all, you know, they all go to the same schools. They all vacation in the same places. They all eat the same things, right? There's so much disdain for the McDonald's and the pizza and the, you know, it's like everybody is healthy, and they even dress very similarly. They speak the same, more politically correct lingo. I often say sometimes this vocabulary game is more like a game of gotcha, you know, because, you know, with all these correct terms that you're supposed to use now, is it Latino or Latinx or all these different terms? Somebody in rural Ohio, are they going to know how to say that? And when they don't say it, it's like, oh, you're a racist or you're, you know, a homophobe. And right. It's just not a way for unifying. So that is a very good point. One solution that is actually very practical. I love this idea of, and other people have mentioned it too, which is why I think it could work. It's the idea of some sort of national service program. So, you know, we used to have the draft, right? And back then, that we had elites back then too. It's like, we've always had elites. But for years, people, the Second World War, First World War, elites, you know, rich kids' sons would go fight alongside poor people. We don't have that anymore. So now my idea is, like, you know, right after high school, a lot of people take gap years. And most elites, they will go to like Guatemala, or they will go with all their friends to Australia or Amsterdam, and they'll do amazing things. I'm not knocking it.
Yes.
But they often go in their own little bubble, like with all their friends. So what if those people, instead of going to another country, what if we had a program, whether it's mandatory or encouraged? Pete Buttigieg, you know, recommended this too, as well as a lot of veterans. You know, you're encouraged to go to another part of the country where you would ordinarily never go. And, you know, so you're from New York City, you went to a private school, you go to someplace in Kentucky or rural, whatever, Virginia. And you work alongside somebody of your age on some sort of public service project, building houses or something. After COVID, there's so much. Not in this, like, I love Teach for America, but I'm not talking about that. Not this, like, let us enlighten you, you know, but more of an equal, which is you're young, you meet people, and you cannot talk about, did you vote for Trump or not Trump, but mm-hmm. just work side by side. So I think there are a lot of studies, optimistic studies, that show that if two people meet as individuals first, okay, so you take two people and one's a Trump voter and one's a hates Trump, and they just, you spend like, you know, a day first talking about sports, pets, dogs, pizza, and then you introduce the politics, way better, way better, you know. Whereas if you introduce each other as opposite sides of a political spectrum, you can't even get a conversation going.
You know, I'm glad we're going to end with this last bit here, because I really enjoyed, I think the best podcast appearance you did to promote the book was your episode of Ezra Klein. And Ezra was pushing you in a pessimistic direction. You kept pushing back, saying we have to be optimistic. So I want to capture this at the end, but do it in a semi-roundabout way. I actually totally disagree with you on the national service point, because what I was saying earlier, that there isn't a policy solution to this dynamic. Yeah. Because in this tribalized America, I seriously really do love your framework. I love the idea of like market dominant minorities. Every program and every policy becomes so hyper-partisan that we can't actually look at a national service program and see it as something that Fox News viewers and moderate Republicans and DSA Democrats and general upper middle class people in like Bethesda would look at and see as this neutral policy. Instead, each group will see that policy through their own lens. So I guarantee you, the second that Biden or Pete Buttigieg will propose that policy, A, you'd immediately get a reaction of, well, this is just Pete Buttigieg's gravy train to get ready for his election. Man. You would get, and Sagar, I know you know this one too, you would get a Fox News segment saying, oh my gosh, is like Joe Biden going to make everyone do fake CRT programs to do it? Like that is just never going to happen. So what's so frustrating about this moment is I do not think we can look at any policy through a pure merit-based degree. So I'm really not trying to argue against what you're saying on a policy perspective, more from the perspective of if we buy your framework of tribalism, what does that actually mean for policy? And what I think I would say here is that to your question of what is the solution, Sagar, I say the solution is democracy. That's why I live in New York City, Eric Adams getting elected off of the back of black and brown working class voters by pushing back on ridiculous, like upper middle class orthodoxy, pushing back on the idea that most black people or Hispanic people feel a way that this market terminated minority wants them to feel is actually the useful corrective. I think it's actually very useful whether or not Gavin Newsom loses in California, that there's an actual check on the idea that these policies can be imposed within a single blue state. So I think democracy and the incentives that politicians will get in the 2020s is why I feel optimistic. But I'd love to clear and just finish with what you're feeling optimistic. Oh, I guess it's been 3 years since the episode. So maybe you're not optimistic. I'd love to hear where you're, get your temperature check.
Yeah, I mean, I've constantly in all this controversy, so I shouldn't be optimistic, because our campuses are just getting more and more crazy, more and more torn. Now you can't even, I used to love teaching because I'd have like some member of the Federal Society in my small group with very left-wing person, and they would argue, then go out for a beer. Right now, if you even have a friend who's a member of the Federal Society, you are fence off adjacent, and you're going to be shamed and bullied. So the dynamic is tough, but the optimist in me kind of dovetails with your point about democracy. I'm very controversial, and it always seems like I'm about to be canceled, but then I just get the wait list from my class, and it's like 120 people, right? And Yale is a small school. Like there are only 200 people per class.
It's like half the class.
and so I always get one of the most popular. So there's a disconnect. And my point here is I really think that the stuff you're seeing on social media, the real hate, the real extreme, is actually a smaller minority than you think. It's a loud and shrill smaller minority that is kind of doing this. And they often run the show when you hear it, and that's all you hear. And it's certainly what you see on cable news. But the reason you got the result when you mentioned Eric Adams, or even you saw whatever you oppose or like, hate Biden or like him, you can see that he did a more moderate thing to get elected. I think that, I've come to fan of democracy too. It's the best method for self-correcting that we have. I still am a little bit, I'm optimistic, but I'm worried about how we are teaching our young people history, because it goes back to what I think needs to be the thing that connects our country together. It's got to be the values of the Constitution. So when I see some directions like, you'll see things like, equality or something like that. It is itself a white supremacist concept. You just see so much crazy dialogue that it does worry me. But I am with you, Marshall. I remain an optimist. I used to go around the country and people at the end would be, oh my gosh, Professor Chiu, is there another country out there that can be a model for us in overcoming our political tribalism? And I would say, no. We are the best model. They're always expecting me to say Canada.
Scandinavia.
Scandinavia. No. But I'm like, it feels awful right now. We're going through some growing pains precisely because of these demographic transformations. And there's a lot of ugliness, and I've been hit personally by it. But I actually think just structurally, just in terms of the formula that we have, kind of our foundations, we are the best equipped country in the world to deal with these forms of political tribalism. So in a way, backhanded way, I'm kind of agreeing with your point because, we are a free market democracy.
Yeah. Well, Professor Chu, it's been really a pleasure speaking with you. Can't thank you enough for joining us. We're going to have links down there in the description to all of your books. We really appreciate it. Is there anywhere you want people to go and find you or buy your book specifically?
Oh, no. It's so great to be with you guys. I mean, I'm on Twitter at Amy Chua. I've got a Facebook page that's got a lot of the Tiger Mom stuff on it. I'm also accessible at Yale. My email's public. So folks should reach out. But it was such a pleasure. It was great to talk to you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Hope you guys enjoyed the episode. Reminder, Substack, subscription, bookshop, book purchases, and of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.